We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. Or visit preborn.com.
Feature-length documentary Culture Warrior, Don Wildman and the Battle for Decency, premiering November 11th, chronicles the life and ministry of Don Wildman. It takes you through the founding of the National Federation for Decency, what has become AFA. It's a call to stand firm for righteousness and shows how that resolve can make a huge difference in our world.
If we lose this cultural war, we're going to have a hedonistic, humanistic society.
Find out more and watch the trailer at culturewarrior.movie.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Monday, December 9th, and the top headline this morning is coming from a town hall. World leaders line up to meet Donald Trump in France. This is, of course, very different from the world leaders that were speaking very ill and making fun of him for the last 4 years. And so town hall says this: before he even assumed office, President-elect Donald Trump met with world leaders to establish early lines of communication. He set the tone for the successive 4 years of his administration. The meetings came before the reopening of the Notre Dame Cathedral, 5 years after it was set on fire. Trump showcased his unorthodox approach to foreign relations, focusing on strengthening bilateral ties, asserting America's interests, and laying the groundwork for his America First agenda. Meanwhile, this coming as the United States under, Biden is still in office for at least the next about a little over 30 days, unfortunately. So the U.S. launches strikes in Syria, igniting backlash after Trump's warning to avoid Middle East quagmire. This coming from the Gateway Pundit. So the United States Central Command, or CENTCOM, launched a series of precision airstrikes against ISIS in central Syria this Sunday. This coming, of course, after Syria has undergone a complete regime change and rebels enter Damascus as al-Assad appears to flee into Russia. So a lot going on the foreign policy and world stage. So let's welcome in Scott Uhlinger, who is a former intelligence agent, to break it all down. So, Scott, where do you want to start?
Well, I guess you could say that this really is, it's news. It's not good news, because what a lot of people don't understand is that the Assad regime was bad. But what we're potentially looking at is a new regime could be even worse. Specifically, what that means is that Assad, for all of his horrible leadership and the fact he was a dictator, was he protected the minorities within his country, because he himself belonged to a minority. He was an Alawite. But specifically, he protected the Christian community within Syria, relatively speaking. And now that that his regime is gone, now we have HTS, which Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, is the group that is the, quote, freedom fighters that are liberating Damascus. But the head of them is named as al-Jalani. And to give you some understanding, he was al-Baghdadi's deputy. And al-Baghdadi was the head of ISIS in Iraq when it was a real threat that Trump took out. So we have basically a terrorist. He's an absolute terrorist, is running the country now. And so that is not really good news for the United States or anyone else.
No, and the United States declared HTS a terrorist organization. I think it was back in 2018 or so. And so how does this How does this factor in at all to what Biden or his administration appears to be doing now with the U.S. forces against ISIS inside Syria?
Yeah, very good question. It's an absolute disaster, and it shows Biden's absolute incompetence in dealing with this. I mean, you just spoke about news that the United States was bombing targets in ISIS, and I presume that that's the truth. But yet, if they're bombing targets in ISIS, then how are they supporting HTS? Or is HTS saying they're not affiliated with ISIS now? I mean, it's an unbelievable mess in Syria. And to attempt to understand it is ridiculous for U.S. policy, especially at this early point in the conflict, so to speak. But Trump has already tweeted that this is not our fight at all. And that is absolutely the position that must be taken right now. This is just an unbelievable mess. And it shows you how bad the deep state is, that they feel compelled to always take a side, even when it's not clear that that side is in any way upholding U.S. interests.
Well, and so do you think, Scott Uhlinger, this was an intel failure by the CIA? I mean, what's going on here?
That's a very good question. Now, there's some people who say that, you know, the CIA is behind this. Frankly, I don't know. I don't have access to that information. But I'll say it's a possibility. However, there are some people I respect. Sam Faddis is his name. And he has a podcast and a website. And he has put out that this constitutes a massive failure of CIA intel, because basically we have a 50-year regime run by the Assad family, first his father and now the principal, who now has fled to Russia, we believe, or maybe dead. No one really knows. But this regime that lasted more than 50 years has fallen relatively suddenly within 2 weeks. And it seems as though the CIA is absolutely flat-footed about this. They have no idea that this was happening, and that just goes to show you the article that I had read by Sam Faddis was excellent and pointed out that, because he's a former station chief like myself, that you know, the forces of DEI have destroyed the actual competence of the agency, and that the people in the field in the, of the CIA who are fulfilling field positions are no longer competent to really do operational spy work. So I have no doubt that this is basically a failing of U.S. intel.
And the article you reference, you sent to me yesterday as well, and I reviewed it. So we have this here. It's from And Magazine, and the title is Flying Blind, Another Intelligence Failure in Syria. It's by Sam Faddis, for listeners who want to go and check out that article and listen to more. And I'm talking with Scott Uhlinger, who's a former intelligence agent. And where does this exactly position the United States? Because reports are also suggesting that Turkey is now allying with Syria, but they're a NATO member, an NTO member. So, you know, how is this setting up the positioning on the world stage for Trump to then go into office? It almost seems like the Biden administration is trying on purpose to just completely make an absolute mess of everything to distract Trump in his first 100 days or more in office. I mean, that's kind of my read on it as an outsider, not in the intelligence community.
But I think that as an outsider, I mean, that is the correct assumption. I mean, it seems pretty clear at this point that is the intent of the Biden administration, to make the foreign affairs portfolio so difficult that the Trump administration is working on that and isn't working at doing things like reducing the size of the deep state through DOGE and things like that. Let's distract Trump to prevent him from doing the reform that the American people demand. So I really think that is a factor. And Turkey is a real problem. Okay, Turkey is a member of NATO. They've been a member of NATO since the early 50s, and they have been a good member of NATO until Erdogan took over his country, I guess, about 15 years ago, because basically they have lurched way over to the religious side. They were a secular state before that, and before Erdogan, and now they are not. And now they're basically putting their fingers into all kinds of messes in the Middle East and beyond. And they were absolutely supporting HTS, which perhaps puts us in a, which does put us in a very difficult position. By the way, another minority group that's going to be affected by this is not only the Christians, but also the Kurds, because the Kurds are the largest ethnic group that does not have a country in the world. They cover areas of Syria, Iraq, and other countries in the area. And so, and by the way, and Turkey, and Turkey has been absolutely conducting a genocide against the Kurds for more than 10 years now. It doesn't make the papers, it doesn't make the news, but it's happening even as we speak. And so this is, I guess, another effort of Erdogan to hurt the Kurds. And so eventually the United States and Turkey are going to have a serious sitting down about the fact that how can Turkey, a member of NATO, be doing all this stuff? And so I think this is something Trump is going to have to deal with. On the positive side, Iran is part of the forces that were supporting Assad, which are now defeated. So what I'm saying is another defeat. This is another defeat by of Iran, which is very important in the area. So in other words, Hamas has been crushed, Hezbollah is on the run, and now the Iranian and Russian-backed government in Syria has fallen. So what we're looking at right now is that probably Iran is at the absolute weakest point it has ever been since the 1979 revolution. And that's something to remember. And you know, Israel certainly knows that, and you know, they've disabled Iran's nuclear or its defensive capability, meaning Iran is an open sky just waiting for the Israeli Air Force to take out their nukes. And now this is another blow to the Khomeini regime. And so that is good news for the region, and that's good news for the United States. But as you can see, this is a very, very mixed bag.
Yeah, to say the least. And I'm talking with Scott Uhlinger, who's a former intelligence agent, about the situation now in Syria. And, you know, this is just a one part of a bigger global stage with so many different conflicts going on. And so before we get to how this affects Saudi and Israel, how does this, you mentioned the Kurds, but how will this situation in Syria affect specifically Syrian Christians?
Right. I mean, the Syrian Christians are looking at now, there were about Syrian Christians were about 10% of the population, let's say 15 years ago. Now they're about 3% of the population because they've either been killed or they fled the country. And so, you know, you've got a regime now. The leader of al-Jalani has already declared, I think it was in Aleppo, that it would be Sharia law already. So in other words, well, Sharia law is not really conducive to Christianity. And so suddenly these people are going to be living under the shadow of a potential genocide. It's very possible. And so this is something that everyone has to watch out for and everyone has to pray for. This is something, yes, I'm very concerned about. With the Kurds, the United States has always supported the Kurds because the Kurds, ironically, are one of the best allies in the area the United States has had. And they were instrumental in the crushing of ISIS under the Trump administration only a few years ago. So now we have the case of a NATO ally. Turkey, perhaps, you know, is going to be probably renewing the attacks on the Kurds, not just the Kurds that live in Turkey because they cover several countries, but also the Kurds that are in Syria itself. And that puts the United States in a difficult position. Are we going to be killing Turks to prevent the Kurds from being killed when Turkey is a NATO member? I mean, it's an absolute mess. And again, the fact that the Biden administration thinks it should or it could support one side is absolute madness. We need to see how everything is going to shake out with this. And we need to protect or do what we can, at least with diplomacy first, to protect these minority groups and maybe, you know, prevent any kind of a genocide before it happens.
Yeah, we absolutely need to be praying for the Syrian Christians. And, you know, there's so much interplay here. And so how does this affect what's going on in Israel, because we also have a clip that I want to get to as well from Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday on Syria. This is cut one.
This is a historic day for the Middle East. The collapse of the Assad regime, the tyranny in Damascus, offers great opportunity, but also is fraught with significant dangers. This collapse is a direct result of our forceful action against Hezbollah and Iran, Assad's main supporters. It set off a chain reaction of all those who want to free themselves from this tyranny and its oppression. But it also means we have to take action against possible threats. One of them is the collapse of the Separation of Forces Agreement from 1974 between Israel and Syria. This agreement held for 50 years. Last night it collapsed. The Syrian army abandoned its positions. We gave the Israeli army the order to take over these positions to ensure that no hostile force embeds itself right next to the border of Israel. This is a temporary defensive position until a suitable arrangement is found. Equally, we send a hand of peace to all those beyond our border in Syria, to the Druze, to the Kurds, to the Christians, and to the Muslims who want to live in peace with Israel. We're going to follow events very carefully. If we can establish neighborly relations and a peaceful relations with the new forces emerging in Syria, that's our desire. But if we do not, we'll do whatever it takes to defend the state of Israel and the border of Israel.
All right, so that's Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday, and he's saying this is a historic day for the Middle East, the collapse of the Assad regime, and of course, they're still in the midst of that whole unrest, and Assad, at least reportedly, was granted asylum in Russia, and Russia still has the current conflict with Ukraine, and the United States is sending so much of the aid to Ukraine. I mean, this just seems like there are so many different players. I'm kind of confused, Scott, as to where, you know, the United States ultimately ends up, if we're or which side we're on with the Biden administration kind of sending a lot of mixed signals, I think. But your reaction to Netanyahu's statement?
Yeah, Netanyahu is doing absolutely what needs to be done, because Syria, you know, we signed the Israel signed an agreement with Syria that basically a country that almost no longer exists. Their army, you know, Syria has fought Israel in the 67 war and the 73 war, and now their forces have evaporated. And so the Israelis need to fill that power vacuum until they figure out who's running the country. And as he said, it's a temporary thing. But like to also to add further detail, see, you have to understand that Hezbollah is a Shia organization, Shia Muslims. And that's why Iran, that's particularly why Iran loves them and supports them, because Iran is a Shia Muslim country, which is in the minority in the Middle East. The HTS, the quote freedom fighters that have liberated Damascus, are a Sunni group. Okay, they are a Sunni group, the same as like Hamas. Now, the HTS has announced that they will continue to fight Hezbollah. So in other words, you know, remember, this is a lot of this conflict is Muslim against Muslim. So it's going to be the Sunnis. HTS said that they're going to continue their war on Hezbollah. So in that sense, that certainly is a good thing, because Hezbollah is absolutely evil and deserves to be destroyed. But just because HTS is the enemy of your enemy, of our enemy, does not mean they're our friend, and we need to proceed very gradually and not, like the Biden administration said, pell-mell into supporting this group until we see that, A, they're not going to conduct genocide against the Christians, the Druze, or the Kurds within their own country, Syria. And, you know, and I would, you know, be very skeptical about any alliance with this group, because they were affiliated with ISIS, or at least their leadership was. So again, this is a case where the United States needs to step back and not get highly involved in this, because you can even see Israel is not really getting involved in the sense. Israel is certainly not going to be supporting HTS against Hezbollah. Hezbollah is the enemy of Israel, but Netanyahu is a lot smarter than Biden, and he is going to, you know, basically, okay, we're going to take these border positions because we don't really trust you guys in the new Syrian government. We're going to see what's going on. If you want to attack Hezbollah, okay, whatever. But you know, we're not going to give you help with that. And we're just going to see what you're all about. Because, you know, Israel has also had problems with Sunni terrorist groups like Hamas. And so, you know, they are looking at this much more smartly. And, of course, the United States isn't, mostly because we want to complicate, or the United States wants to make, or I should say the leftist communists, want to make the transition more difficult for Trump, which is mostly why I think this is happening.
Yeah, and just really quick as we're headed into the break, Scott Uhlinger, can Trump get a hold of this? I mean, are we going to be too far down the rabbit hole in the next, you know, 30 plus days, or can Trump turn this around pretty quickly?
No, I think that Trump can turn it around. I don't think that it will have gotten so far along that we cannot turn it off. And in fact, you know, Trump's reputation as a peacemaker, because that is his reputation, he will be able to turn it off no matter what the Biden administration does. He can simply say, okay, look, we're not doing this anymore, because I don't think he's afraid to do that. And I think Trump will be attuned to the risks to the Syrian minorities. And he's not going to
Well said. And Scott Uhlinger, we got to leave it there. Always appreciate your comments. We'll be right back with more. Could the fate of America's children be tied to the fate of our nation itself? Much like the abortionists who end the lives of the unborn, the left is determined to undermine the pro-life movement. First, they target the babies. Then they come for the rest of us. Preborn stands as a beacon of hope for the most defenseless among us, preborn babies. Every day, Preborn's network of clinics rescue, on average, over 200 babies while surrounding expectant mothers with God's love and offering a free ultrasound. Rescuing the miracle of life has never been more crucial as we navigate this time of moral decline in our nation. Will you join Preborn in protecting the least among us? For just $28, you can sponsor an ultrasound and give a mother the chance to choose life, not only for her baby, but for herself. An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com. That's preborn.com/AFR. preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And the Daniel Penny jury enters day five of deliberations after kind of a wild ride late on Friday. The manslaughter charge, which was the highest charge in that case for Daniel Penny, was dismissed by the judge. So you'll recall that Daniel Penny is the 25-year-old former Marine who intervened on a New York City subway to restrain a man named Jordan Neely, who was a homeless person after Neely began threatening passengers last year. And this coming from Breitbart, Penny will no longer face a manslaughter charge in Neely's death. Penny placed Neely in a chokehold for several minutes, then let go. Neely later died, though he was still alive when the police arrived, and the defense wanted the judge in this case to declare a mistrial after the jury said that they were deadlocked in the deliberations over that highest charge, but had said, or had indicated at least, that they had reached a resolution on the lesser included. And this kind of sets up a potential for appeal and a lot of things that we can break down on this. So let's welcome in Will Chamberlain, who is an attorney and a senior counsel at the Article 3 Project. So, Will, there's a lot of discussion over kind of the prosecutor's strategy here, because you have them dismissing and asking the judge to dismiss, and he did, the highest charge, but now you go to the lesser included, which, according to the jury instructions in this case, it appeared to be that the jury was supposed to render a verdict on the manslaughter charge before getting to the criminally negligent homicide. So is this setting up a case or a scenario where prosecutors can then game the system by overcharging, and then if the jury takes too long to deliberate, they can just say, well, we'll dismiss the highest charge, hoping to get a conviction in the lesser included, which is really unfair, it seems like, to the defense?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's very unfair. I think it allows for the kind of situation where you're also getting this coercive dynamic on the jury, because the jury wants to go home, right? So if you not only like make them go through all the pain of deliberating when they can't come to a conclusion when they're going to be hung, which it takes a while. Like this is, we're coming up on what, 4 days of deliberations already last week. And then you're like, okay, well, you came to a mistrial on that count. We're just going to dismiss that one. And now you have to do it all over again on a lesser included count. That doesn't seem right to me. It seems like a way to extract a guilty verdict. It seems like that's, when you heard about the judge, how they talked about doing this move instead of just declaring a mistrial, I mean, the judge described it as, oh, we'll give this a shot. It's like, no. You don't give new legal theories a shot in a criminal trial against the interests of a criminal defendant. That's not how our system works.
Yeah. So what are Daniel Penny's attorneys arguing? I mean, obviously, they're going to be objecting to this. And doesn't this set up a really good issue on appeal if he is convicted?
Yeah. I mean, I think the argument is that it can lead to a legally incoherent verdict. Like the verdict form becomes quite confusing. They were only supposed to proceed to the lesser included charge if they found that Penny wasn't justified. But they couldn't come to a conclusion on that on the first count, obviously, because it hangs. So there at least somebody on that jury, very likely, who believes that Penny was justified. And if that's the case, and the jury instructions are confusing and don't include the justification element properly in the second part, then perhaps he could, you know, it could be just a legally incoherent verdict, one where he should have been acquitted but ends up getting convicted because the jury instructions confused the jury. And that would obviously be a massive issue on appeal.
Yeah. So I'm not, you know, familiar with the inside out of New York's process, and I'm not sure, you know, if you are or not, Will Chamberlain, but, you know, at least according to reports, I mean, is this something that should have been taken care of or was perhaps a foreseeable issue when the attorneys were reviewing the jury instructions? Or is this, you know, maybe something that now they're just dealing with that ultimately, you know, was just kind of a bad situation all around?
You know, I think I guess I just would start with the prosecution shouldn't have been brought in the first place, quite obviously. I mean, it's just quite obviously a clear case of self-defense. In terms of, like, I don't know enough about the weeds of New York procedure to understand, like, how they could have fixed this or, you know, what they did wrong here. But, I still think that it really shouldn't happen this way. I think lawyers I trust in New York say that this is not how things happen in New York. That they can't find a case justifying this approach, and that it should have simply been declared a mistrial.
Wow. Well, we still need to be praying for Daniel Penny. And, you know, this raises a broader question as well about how the left overall and the leftist worldview is treating the entire issue of the right to self-defense. Because there was an article yesterday in the Daily Mail, and the headline is, a U.S. woman, 20, accidentally stabs an illegal, apparently, or a migrant, 64, to death after struggle after he groped her at a German train station. And she is now facing up to 10 years in prison. So she accidentally, you know, in this struggle, she had a knife, apparently. And according to this report, in that struggle, in order to fend off this attacker, accidentally kills him in the process of him committing an assault on her. And now in Germany, she's facing up to 10 years in prison for this. I mean, it seems like overall, in a lot of the Western countries, the right to self-defense is being extremely intentionally limited or completely foreclosed overall. I mean, I can only imagine, and this is, you know, absolutely heinous, if you're in that situation, you're not sitting here thinking, oh, am I using too much excessive force to get, you know, this assaulting attacker off of me? I mean, you just want to get out of the situation. So how problematic are a lot of these cases to the overall right to self-defense?
I think they're very problematic in general. I think that's one of the big left's big projects. They don't really recognize the right to defend yourself from violence. And if anything, the right they seem to recognize is the right to kill people who are leading industries that you find disfavorable. It seems pretty clear that the left has a much more hostile view of Daniel Penny defending himself and others in that train car than they do of the guy who murdered in cold blood the health insurance executive. And it's a really harsh reminder that, yes, we've seen these people before. They've been around historically. They're communists. They're the people who led the Russian Revolution and, murdered every person who was quote unquote bourgeois, you know, that they could get their hands on, and just generally have a hostile view to anybody who is, you know, successful in producing value in society. But then at the same time, it's like if somebody wants to defend themselves against, you know, in this case, somebody who was groping them in a train station, a complete stranger groping them in a train station, it's like, oh, no, you don't get to do that. You just need to sit and tolerate it.
And I'm speaking with Will Chamberlain, who is the senior counsel at the Article 3 Project, and this whole idea of self-defense. But then also, you're absolutely right to draw that contrast between the reaction, you know, here in the U.S., between the Daniel Penning case that happened in New York City, and then also the cold-blooded murder of this the United Healthcare CEO and that executive. And they're still, as of today, searching for that killer. That manhunt is still going on, and the left on one hand is saying that Daniel Penney should rot in prison for protecting the public, really, on that subway, and yet they're applauding the cold-blooded outright just murder of this CEO. And so, you know, what does this say about our society and the view of not only law and order, but how we view just the sanctity of human life?
Yeah, it doesn't say very much good about it. It says that we've got a large political faction in this country that is, you know, basically on the side of criminals and the violent and against in just fundamentally any civilization. It doesn't mean that, I'm not saying health insurance is the only way to structure your healthcare system, but it's, you know, one of the hard, it's very hard to do privately without some sort of insurance structure. And, you know, the funny thing is, it's like people blame health insurers for why healthcare is so expensive when health insurance is only, you know, the revenue generated by health insurance companies, or rather the profit generated, is something like 1% of all healthcare expenditures. The money you spend on healthcare isn't going to the insurance companies. 99% of it is going to the doctors and the medical institutions. So, and, you know, people seem just to blame insurance off of that. So that's a side note. It's obviously clearly appalling that you just, somebody's in an industry that you don't think very much of. Well, let's just kill the CEO. And like, let's laugh about how funny it is that the CEO was killed. I don't know. It's a relief that these people don't have any political power anymore.
Yeah, and yet we still have at least, you know, 30 plus days, unfortunately, of Biden, and you know he's talking about potentially pardoning anyone in his administration, and even extending that to people who sat on the January 6th committee, or even people who spoke out against Donald Trump, like Adam Schiff. And of course, he was part of the whole Mueller investigation and that whole sham, you know, the Russia collusion hoax. So, you know, how problematic is that in terms of our overall commitment to law and order? Because while, of course, you know, Biden does have the power of pardon, it was not intended to be used for that type of political purpose.
Yeah, I mean it's a new world in terms of pardons. I actually don't know that it's going to end up being a worse world, because what it does mean is, I mean, if Biden does something like this, like some broad sweeping preemptive pardon for officials in his administration, well, that's going to be the new default, right? Certainly Trump's going to do that when he leaves office. And I think there's positives to that. One is that it'll end this sort of tit for tat weaponization that leads to everybody getting thrown in jail and everybody getting prosecuted. So, you know, I would prefer, I think we should, honestly, as the right, would be willing to bring these prosecutions, because, you know, we do need to deter the Democrats from pulling a stunt like this in the future. But if there's a world where, I mean, you know, the one benefit of Democrats doing this is they've certainly set a precedent for us. If they try and do this widespread pardon. And then the second beneficial thing is that we'll be able to bring all these people in front of Congress and make them testify, because it'll be very hard for them to claim that they have a reasonable fear of self-incrimination when they've got a broad-based preemptive pardon for any federal crimes. So hopefully that'll be some useful. I mean, I don't know. I'm not as depressed about this. I think that, you know, because to me, the status quo I am much more worried about the status quo where, were, you know, the Democrats clearly were willing to prosecute anybody and everybody associated with President Trump in his first term. And I think that's the world that leads to banana republics. So the world of mass pardon seems like a safer one, even if it's less committed to the rule of law nominally.
Yeah, and you know, and that's a very valid point. I mean, our justice system has always said, you know, better to let 10 guilty go free than one innocent person be convicted of something that, you know, they're not actually responsible for, they're not actually guilty of. And so, you know, at least in terms of that maxim, you know, maybe we're a little bit into that area, but it's still, you know, overall problematic. And of course, you know, if Trump had done that leaving office his first time and had just issued mass pardons, then I can only imagine how the Democrats would have just, you know, raise absolute bloody murder and said, you know, no, we're not going to abide by that. And now here they are 4 years later and, oh, well, this is in the Constitution and Biden can do it. And nobody in media is even batting an eye. So the hypocrisy, of course, is on full display. But when is it not with the Democrats? So anyway, we're already out of time. But Will Chamberlain, really appreciate you dropping by this morning. Senior counsel at the Article 3 Project. They do great work over there. You can follow them on X as well as Will Chamberlain. And we will be praying for Daniel Penny and the outcome of that case, which may be later on today. But we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And while all eyes have been on, well, at least in the media, on Pete Hegseth and his potential nomination or failing nomination for Secretary of Defense, and a lot of the Trump supporters are rallying to his defense, let's talk about Trump's health care nominees and whether or not they may survive Senate confirmation if indeed Trump does not do the whole recess appointment, at least in the interim, but eventually they would have to come before the Senate. And so, of course, we're talking about several. This would be Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Dr. Jeanette Nishwat, Jay Bhattacharya, and Dr. Marty Markery. So Katie Talento, who has served for years on Capitol Hill, worked with the Trump transition team, and then served as President Trump's top health advisor in the White House Domestic Policy Council prior to the pandemic, joins us now, and she is currently with the Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries. Katie, you know, let's talk about some of these more controversial nominees.
So I don't know that I would call them controversial. I mean, these are all physicians. They are articulate communicators of public health messages. But nonetheless, I mean, except for Bobby Kennedy Jr., of course, who's not a physician, but he has been in the public health space for decades, working you know, to try to bring regulatory agencies to heel. So I think that is qualifying. I don't think that any of them are unqualified. I do think that they are a threat. Many of them, several of them, are a serious threat to the big medicine, big pharma, big food status quo. And as such, they are in trouble, not just their nominations, but I would argue that their safety is in trouble. We see what just happened to the UnitedHealthcare CEO, and these are some of the darkest forces on the planet. These giant corporate interests, they have a lot of resources. They have the most lobbyists of any industry by far in Washington, and they have not been cloaking themselves in glory for many decades. So I do think that these guys have a lot to worry about when it comes to the influences that will be raised against them in the Senate, and I hope that senators will steel themselves and do the right thing.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. And that's a very good point that we should all be praying for their safety and just for the overall process, that, you know, America would be a little better than perhaps it has been lately. And, you know, the nominee that certainly I don't think is controversial and I'm the most excited about is Dr. Jay Bhattacharya. He's been a frequent guest actually on this program, and I know him personally. He was nominated to run the National Institutes of Health, or the NIH, but he was a very prominent critic of Anthony Fauci during the lockdowns, and even counseled President Trump in the midst of 2020 to maybe take a different approach than a lot of the lockdowns. But contrast that with Dr. Jeanette Nishwat, who is the nominee for Surgeon General. She was very vocal for some of the more restrictive, and now, you know, we can, hindsight, of course, is 2020. You know, no pun intended. I think that phrase is always interesting now. But for some of those unnecessary measures during the pandemic. And so is that going to those different perspectives? Could those pose a problem in terms of confirmation for each of those nominees respectively?
Yeah, I do think you're right. I think in terms of just absolute competence and getting things right, the Surgeon General nominee is probably the most in trouble or at risk at that on that front. I will say that many doctors, epidemiologists, I'm an epidemiologist. I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist by training, and I had to wake up during COVID, and it took me a minute. I was, especially during the Trump administration, I was no longer in the administration, but I was sympathetic and I was inclined to want to support them. The president was running for reelection. I was inclined to want to be verbally supportive, in the media and elsewhere. And so it took me a minute to wake up and see, wait a minute, this is cray cray. It's not even scientifically valid and it's, unconstitutional. And I give a little bit of grace. I do think that it maybe took her a little longer than it should have. But MDs are so, they're such products of the sort of groupthink religious cult that is modern medicine and medical education, that I am willing to give grace to somebody if they truly came around. So I'll be interested to hear her story of how she woke up, how she realized that she was wrong, where she thinks the administration went off track, and how to avoid doing that in the future, what she's learned from it, what we've all learned from it. Maybe she has a really compelling story about that, and I'll be interested to hear. I agree with you 100% about Dr. Bhattacharya, 100%. Dr. Marty McCary, who's been nominated for the FDA commissioner, I, too, have known him for a very long time. We met in grad school decades ago, and he is similar to, he's kind of a mix between the two other nominees in that at first he was, kind of in that MD mode and assumed that vaccines were safe and good. And, but he slowly, more gradually came around, but came around in force. And he was a mainstream articulate voice for sanity, unlike Dr. Bhattacharya, who through no fault of his own, and unlike some of the other doctors and experts that got canceled. Dr. McCary managed to keep sort of his mainstream credibility and therefore his platform to really have a huger influence. So, excuse me, I'm very hopeful that he and Dr. Bhattacharya will sail through. I have no doubt. Certainly, I'm worried about Mr. Kennedy, and I think that how his nomination goes is entirely dependent on how Pete Hegseth's nomination goes, because certainly if a senator is going to vote against Pete, they're going to have similar reasons and maybe more to vote against Mr. Kennedy. I hope that both those nominees will get through. And I certainly, I was so encouraged when Kennedy was nominated. I mean, I just can't imagine someone that's more threatening to what is broken in our healthcare system. And certainly what is threatening the public health of America, the chronic illness epidemic, which, the establishment, the health establishment is simply profiting from, certainly not taking on. So I'm very encouraged by his nomination. I really hope that senators will not be influenced by the money and the lies that come out of these giant industries.
We can only hope for maybe a little less corruption on Capitol Hill than per the usual. But I'm talking with Katie Tolento, who is now with the Alliance of Healthcare Sharing Ministries, formerly with the Trump administration and the Trump transition team. And, the whole specter of confirmation hearings, this is something, quite frankly, this whole COVID response conversation has been something that Trump has avoided for the last 4 years. In talking about, hasn't really come back and made a thorough assessment. I think for a lot of people who even are very ardent supporters, would have liked him to talk about his own thought process through the last 4 years. Is this kind of setting up a scenario where some even Republican senators who maybe don't have the team player aspect in mind could use this type of forum really to go at President Trump through these nominees and just raising the whole conversation of the COVID response again?
Well, of course. I mean, we know that Democrat senators are going to attack these nominees because they really want to attack President Trump. That's especially true for Democrats who are attacking a Kennedy, which is ironic at the height. But I do agree with you that I think that I would have liked to see a story, like I just mentioned, around the Surgeon General nominee. I'd like to see a story be told by President Trump about how he's come around and what he learned through the process. But that's not his style ever on any topic. And so I think that we're sort of grasping at windmills, to try to hope that we would see that. But I think watching him reading the tea leaves, I think he has learned a bit. I think it was pretty jarring for him to be booed at his own rally when he was talking about, when he was bragging about the vaccine and Operation Warp Speed. That was the only time I'd ever seen him booed at a rally, and it never stopped. Like, that's not an issue that his base is coming around on at all. And he would be, I think, well advised to drop that line of, of discussion and to really let his nominees speak reason and sanity around that. You know, I think if President Trump were in this conversation, he would say, listen, I never mandated this thing. I just wanted to get it available quickly. But, you know, what I would argue, and I hope that Dr. McCary takes on this problem at the FDA, is that we have regulatory agencies for a reason, to protect the public from these giant corporate interests, not to protect the corporate interests from us and from accountability. Quite the opposite. So it's very important that we don't get so excited about bringing new cures and, you know, speeding through red tape. No, that's how we got to where we are right now, where drugs are often, very often, a net harm, or products like vaccines and devices have almost no clinical trial data, where if they do, it's for 5 days or 100 people, not enough statistical power in order to identify any more rare harms than maybe 1 in 100. You know, if your vaccine it hurts 1 in 1,000 children, you darn well better have a clinical trial that has many thousands of children, or it won't capture that one incident and provide the information we need for parents to make an informed choice. And yet most of the clinical trials for all vaccines on the childhood schedule, except for the COVID vaccine, ironically, all of them have, 100 people, or we watch them for 5 days, or we only, for the Hep B vaccine that we put into babies on the first day of life, we only have data from kids up to 11. So it's really important that we, Republicans, I've been a Republican health staffer my entire career, and we have this knee-jerk defense of industry and wanting to bust through regulatory hurdles to innovation, and that's been our line for all these decades. But if anything has taught us that we've got to get hold of these regulatory agencies and really separate them from the cheerleading function that I think they've gotten into for their regulated industries. You look at the nuclear safety. You have the Department of Energy, which is the cheerleader for the nuclear industry. But then you have the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is the regulator for the nuclear industry. It doesn't go around talking about how great the nuclear industry is. And so this is really important to separate this. We have the same thing, Department of Transportation, cheerleader for the industry, NTSB, regulator of safety. And yet FDA is supposed to be that independent regulator, not the cheerleader. And so it's very important that we really bring some reform to this process and to our own minds, especially in conservative circles.
Yes, so well said. And I think the liability shield for all of these pharmaceutical companies was something that really genuinely was experimental, had not gone through all of the testing phases, long-term studies, impact on, women especially, and, reproductive health and all of those things really was a miscalculation and seemed to be just protecting big pharma instead of protecting the patient, which is, kind of what the government, at least in theory, is supposed to do, protect the individual, not the giant corporation. So in just the last minute I have with you, Katie, and I appreciate your insights. I mean, how much of that kind of thing is, would the Senate perhaps be a little more defensive of, maybe because, they're the ones that allowed for the liability shield?
Yeah, I think there aren't any senators left that were actually there in 1986 that did it. I could be wrong about that, but I don't think so. And so that helps. That gives everybody an out. And certainly this is Congress. This isn't the nominations that we're talking about. It's not the executive branch that can undo that liability shield for the corporate interest. But I agree with you 100%, Jenna, that would be one of the most important things that Congress could do. You know, they're all going to be jacked up about a tax cut and, the Department of Government Efficiency or whatever. But honestly, if you really want to help children and help America, repealing that liability shield so that vaccines have to go through the same safety requirements that drugs do, because they are drugs, You know, they're sort of drugs given to healthy people who don't who aren't sick yet. So there should be an even higher standard on them, not a lower standard on them for safety.
So well said. And Katie Talento, we got to leave it there. But thank you so much for your comments. Would love to have you on again to talk about this more. And hopefully these nominees in all of these directions can do multiple things at once. DOGE plus healthcare plus everything else. As always, you can reach me and my team at Jenna@AFR.net. See you tomorrow morning.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.